You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 11 a.m. and time for Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. Today's guests are Lawrence Howard and Lynn Duddy of Portland Story Theater, and we'll be talking about the next entry in their Armchair Adventurer series, Polar Opposites, Amundsen, Scott, and the Race for the Pole. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Good morning, neighbor. I'm glad we're together again. Just a minute here while I take off my jacket, put on a comfortable sweater, take off my dress shoes and put on a pair of tennis shoes. Can you say tennis shoes? Someone must have lowered the floor here. Mr. Jones is getting a little older. Hope you're getting comfortable, too. We have a very special show for you today on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, the children's program for reluctant adults. I'm the host of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. Today we're talking about the basis of all good radio shows, in fact, all good books, movies, and video for that matter, stories and storytelling. And we couldn't ask for better guests to join us in that pursuit, Lynn Duddy and Lawrence Howard, the principals behind Portland Story Theater. Portland Story Theater is dedicated to the art of personal narrative, and they offer three series of storytelling performances, Urban Tellers, Armchair Adventurer, and Main Stage. We'll get into those more with Lynn and Lawrence, who are, by the way, expert storytellers in their own right. And if we're lucky, we might hear a little of that for ourselves this morning. Lynn and Lawrence, welcome to the neighborhood.
Hey.
Hi,
welcome.
Ken.
Yeah.
Glad
Thanks.
To be here.
It's great.
It is a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Yeah, kind of gloomy, wet, but at least it's not freezing. But we'll talk about freezing places.
Yes, we will.
Lynn, first let's start a little bit about Portland Story Theater. You've been around for 14 seasons now?
Yes, yes.
Can you tell us how you got started and kind of what was the original idea there?
Sure. We were really drawn to storytelling. And we started doing a story circle at our house once a month, just informally, you know, lots of wine and good food and good conversation. And people would share stories. And after a few years of that, I said, hey, let's do a show. So of about the 20 people that came in and out of that story circle, three of them decided to join Lawrence and I. And we became Portland Story Theater. And we had our first show at Coho.
And the first show was in three of the storytellers from the group, plus you and Lawrence?
Correct, yes.
And were those kind of impromptu stories? Were they rehearsed? Because the story circle, it seemed like people were just telling stories off the cuff?
Oh, people would do all kinds of different things, you know, off the cuff. And then they would tell myths and legends. And when Lawrence and I first started telling stories, we didn't do personal narrative. We did myths and ancient stories. And when we did our first story show, Lawrence and I actually did, what was it called? The Moonlit Road?
The Moonlit Road.
But it was
Ambrose Bierce.
Ambrose Bierce. Oh,
we actually told a literary work.
In tandem.
Were you reading it or you had...
No.
No, we memorized it and we told it in tandem. Actually, we didn't tell it word for word as it was written. We sort of customized it to make it work for us and made some of the language more modern. But
because it was written a long time ago, you know, it's in the public domain.
Written around the time of the Civil War.
And you know, when they got paid by the word.
Flower.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So we edited that a bit. But it was very fun, and it was a Halloween show.
Now, Portland Story Theater has three different series
right
now under the auspices of the group, Urban Tellers, Armchair Adventurer, and Main Stage. Can you tell us a little bit about each one?
Sure.
And, of course, we'll be talking quite a bit about Armchair Adventurer today.
Right. Well, the Urban Tellers, that came about, I think, as an offshoot in about 2008 when we started doing personal narrative and people were really interested in telling their own stories. So we started doing workshops just open to the public, ordinary people, the people of Portland. So every month we have an Urban Tellers show where people go through an intensive workshop and then get up on stage and tell their stories. And the Main Stage is also an Urban Tellers, but it's themed, where we don't theme the Urban Tellers themselves prior to the start, it emerges as people go through the workshop and each group comes up with its own theme. But the main stage, we typically have Halloween, Valentine's, and St. Patty's.
And one of the themes for the Urban Tellers, a recent one, was refugees and immigrants.
Well, we started doing that just this last season, and that's been really well received by the community. What we wanted to do was really try to not other people. You know, that's just so much, it's really become very toxic in the United States. A lot of anti-immigrant, anti-refugee sentiments. And what we wanted to do was say, hey, these people are the people of Portland and they live in our community and they're part of our life here. We do not require that people tell their story about being an immigrant or refugee. It's the exact same thing as a regular Urban Tellers in that people just tell a personal story that has deep meaning to them and the themes evolve. So I think one of the Urban Tellers was We Stand Together was the theme that emerged from all the different stories. And we're having another one actually coming up in April.
With all different storytellers.
All new storytellers, yes, yes.
Now, of course, a story is the heart of Portland Story Theater. What do you look for in the stories you tell? In other words, what makes a good story, especially for a live audience?
Well, I think the way we approach the work is really very individual. We encourage people to tell a story that matters to them and that they need to hear. So we always start with the teller themselves and what really matters to them and what's important to them. And then we work outward towards giving the story as a gift to the listeners. So when the person is finally on stage, they can let go of worrying about whether anybody's going to like them or their story because they're giving the story as a gift to the people who are there to receive it.
Do you work with the storytellers to structure those personal narratives then?
Oh, yes.
Before they get on stage?
Yes, we do. We have an approach. I mean, the thing is that storytelling is not one of those art forms that can, you know, hey, follow these five steps. And, I mean, there's a lot of that out there now because storytelling is very popular. But we believe that, you know, every good story has to have a beginning, middle, and an end. There has to be action. There has to be conflict. And if you have those elements, then you have a story. The real thing is getting in tune with the heart voice. That's really our philosophy.
Now, about that beginning, middle, and end, that action, suspense, I think that's a good transition, Lawrence, into the Armchair Adventure Series.
Right.
This actually was my first Portland Story Theater show a few years ago when you told the story of Ernest Shackleton, great explorer of the Antarctic expedition of 1914. And you mentioned that the story was inspired by your dad's great love for Shackleton and his adventures. My wife feels the same way about it. It's just an amazing...
I know your wife's a big Shackleton fan.
Yeah, an amazing story. Yeah. I mean, one of the great men of all time, it seems. Courageous, smart, a great leader. Why did you turn this into a series, and how do you pick the Armchair Adventurer stories? I know you've also included the Essex whaling trip, which inspired Melville's Moby Dick and Nansen of the North.
Right. Well, in a way, all these stories are sort of interconnected. Not so much the Essex, the whaling story, but that's another lifelong interest I inherited from my dad. But, you know, there was a brief period, they call it the heroic era of Antarctic exploration, and there were 3, 4, 5 expeditions to Antarctica, and they're all connected because some of the same people were on, you know, 3 out of the 5 or that, you know, there's a lot of interconnectedness among them. So I grew up with the Shackleton story. I had known that all my life. But of course, Douglas Mawson, who that's the second story in the series, Mawson's Medal, he had been on Shackleton's Nimrod expedition. So just knowing about Shackleton, I knew a little bit about Mawson, and I was like, wow, that was an interesting expedition, too. I should tell that story. And, of course, Shackleton and Scott were great rivals, and their stories are very much interconnected. Shackleton was on Scott's first expedition, the Discovery Expedition, and just growing up knowing about Shackleton, I knew sort of peripherally about all these other explorers. And after I saw what a great response there was to the Shackleton story, I realized that these other stories were really good material that people would be interested in also. And it just seemed natural to make this into a series. I'm really not one to tell the same story over and over and over again. I like to have a new story. So from Shackleton, we went to Nansen, then we went to Polar Opposites, which is the story of Scott and Amundsen and the race to the pole. And of course, even though he was an Arctic guy instead of Antarctic, Fridtjof Nansen was sort of the father of polar travel. He was the oracle. He was the one who showed them all how it could be done. And he sort of mentored all those Antarctic explorers who are my heroes. And I knew that someday, eventually, I would tell his story as well. So they're all sort of interconnected. They're all sort of part of the same body of knowledge, if you will. And that's why I included them all, and it grew into a series.
Well, that Scott Amundsen story is just amazing. I didn't know the Shackleton connection. Shackleton's endurance expedition was 1914.
Right.
Amundsen and Scott were both trying to get to the South Pole late 1911, early 1912.
Right. But Shackleton had been on Scott's first expedition in 1901, 1902, the Discovery Expedition.
Was that also trying to find the or get to the North South Pole?
Yes, yes, yes. That was also Antarctica. They made a base at McMurdo Sound, and they a party of three, just Scott and Wilson and Shackleton, who was young at the time, 28 years old, man-hauled their sledge to 82 degrees and 17 minutes south, which was not terribly close to the pole, but was a world record for the farthest south at that point in time. So that was Shackleton's first experience in the Antarctic as well. And, of course, he and Scott clashed on the Discovery Expedition, and that's the point at which they became not just rivals but sort of enemies for the rest of their lives. And then Shackleton went back to the Antarctic in 1907 as the leader of his own expedition, the Nimrod Expedition. And that's the one where he came to within 97 miles of the pole before he realized that he had enough food and fuel to make it to the pole and, you know, claim that honor and glory, but he didn't have enough food and fuel to make it to the pole and make it back to his base alive. And so just 97 miles from the pole, he had to make that agonizing decision to turn around and head back and save his life and the lives of his companions. And they raced against death and starvation the entire way, but they did make it back alive.
Which is kind of a hallmark of Shackleton. You know, he gets his men back alive.
Get them back alive.
Now, that's why wasn't he on the 1911 Scott expedition then if they were connected like that?
Oh, he and Scott had become enemies on the 1901-1902 Discovery Expedition. There's a little story about that. The three of them were man-hauling their sledge, Scott and Wilson and Shackleton, and they got to 82 degrees and 17 minutes south, and that's still about 500 miles from the pole. And at that point in time, Shackleton was ailing. He was sick. He probably had the very beginning stages of scurvy. And Shackleton was the big, strong guy, right? That's why they brought him along.
You'd never think a guy like that would get sick.
Well, you see this again and again, and it's an interesting thing because, you know, scurvy is a vitamin deficiency.
Right.
And it's the biggest, strongest guy who needs the most fuel, right? Needs the most calories. And because they're all on this very restricted diet and they're all
eating, suffered the most.
He suffers the most. He has the greatest deficiency. And so it happens again and again that the big, strong guy becomes ill first. And Scott was bitterly disappointed that, his big strong guy failed him, that Shackleton failed him, and that they had to turn around and head back. And they had some
very harsh words
out there on the ice, and they became enemies. And in fact, Scott invalided Shackleton home on the relief ship the morning and didn't allow him to stay over for the second year of the Discovery Expedition, and a lifetime of animosity was born there. And there's a good argument to be made that everything that either of those two men did for the rest of their lives was motivated by a deep desire to prove that he was a better man than the other.
And the origins of the story for you, I read that Lynn, you and Lawrence were in Norway, and Amundsen's ship is on display there.
Right, in Fram.
Yes, and interestingly enough, that was the ship that Amundsen took to the South Pole, to Antarctica, but that's the same ship that Fridtjof Nansen took to the Arctic and tried to drift to the North Pole. So it's a ship that has this...
A lot of history.
...enormous role in polar exploration.
Yes.
And Lawrence, you kind of mentioned... you cover both the Arctic and Antarctic in the Armchair Adventures series. And I remember you did a Between the Covers interview for KABOO with Paul Watson
earlier this
year. Paul wrote a book, Ice Ghost, The Epic Hunt for the Lost Franklin Expedition.
Right.
And Franklin's mission was to find that last unexplored section of the Northwest Passage.
Right.
And you had mentioned at the time that you were at a conference, or maybe a few of them, where there seemed to be some kind of division between specialists in Arctic exploration, scholars, I guess.
Very much so. I belong to this group, and they have a meeting every couple of years that they call the South Polesium, and these guys are Antarctic purists. And at these South Polesium events, people are invited to speak about their area of interest or expertise in Antarctic exploration. And the one rule is that none of that Arctic stuff, right? That's a separate deal. And that always surprises me, because it seems to me that they're sort of linked and sort of connected.
Certainly historically, as you just mentioned.
Have a lot in common. But that is the rule. And last year, when I told the Fridtjof Nansen story that I called Nansen of the North, I talked about that, about how... it's sort of like north is north and south is south and never the twain shall meet.
Now, when I saw the Shackleton show that you did, I knew the story very well.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering how you would kind of make that last 2 hours, kind of engage the audience, me in particular. And yet you did. It was extremely suspenseful, even though I knew the ending. And I think maybe a good portion of the audience will come to the polar opposites knowing the story of Scott and Amundsen, and it's a tragic story in many respects. How do you build and maintain that suspense, given these historical events that people know? They know the ending. That won't be a surprise to them, usually.
I don't know. To me, it's not so much the suspense as just the detail. I try to paint the picture. I try to take the audience into the scene. I try to use a lot of quotes and excerpts from the men's diaries or journals or stuff that they wrote later, their own descriptions of the events as they're happening. And to me, it's just really being able to get into the minds and hearts and the characters of the men, the individual players in these epic sagas, and try to give the audience a glimpse of what it felt like to those men. And I also try to set it against the backdrop of the larger sweep of history of the era, of the period. You know, all these expeditions were set against that backdrop of that era, the turn of the century, the promise of technology, the last undiscovered place on Earth, the beginning of the crumbling of the British Empire. It's all in there, Norway's newfound independence from Sweden. All of that kind of plays into the mix, plays into the story.
It really comes down to the emotional truth of the story.
Right.
I mean, we do that in all of our storytelling. But I think especially with this historical insights into the world around us, that Lawrence really gets in tune with the emotional truth. Where were people's hearts and heads at that time when all this was happening, the people right. there on the expedition and the people out in the world.
Yeah. What motivated these guys to risk their lives? I mean, these guys certainly knew that there was a strong possibility of death. Death was on the menu, right?
And some of them almost died in previous expeditions, like Shackleton.
Exactly, exactly. So it's I don't know. These stories also have an element of heroism in them, an element of I don't know. These guys were made of stern stuff. You know, they had a certain toughness, a certain resilience that, you know, in many ways life today is more complicated and probably in some ways more difficult. But on a physical level, life was much tougher then. And these guys had a certain inner strength and a gumption and a character that we today living our softer lives really admire, right? It's how do you draw on those inner reserves of strength? I think there's an important
that resilience.
Lesson. A right. resilience, that's
right.
the word.
And I think that in today's world, we're all looking for ways to build our own resilience in light of what's happening around us.
Right. Good point.
Yeah.
Lawrence, were you going to, very generously, you offered to tell a little excerpt from Polar Opposites.
Sure. There are actually two small excerpts of the story that I would like to tell, two anecdotes. One is the part where, so Amundsen originally was a polar explorer, right? He was the first to successfully complete that Northwest Passage that Franklin had died trying to accomplish. And after that, he set his sights on the North Pole. He wanted to get to the North Pole. And in fact, he wanted to do what Fridtjof Nansen had tried to do 10 or 12 years earlier. He went to Nansen, he asked if he could borrow the Fram, and he wanted to lock the Fram in the Arctic ice and drift over the North Pole. And as he was planning that expedition in April of 1909, Cook and Peary both claimed to have reached the North Pole, and that changed everything for Amundsen. He was not a man who had any interest in going...
Being second,
right. So he repurposed his expedition and decided that he would go south and try to reach the South Pole, but he kept that a secret. He didn't tell the world that, and he kept up this deception. He told no one except his brother Leon, his business manager, and even the men who he hired to come along on this expedition, they had no idea. They left Norway and they sailed south to the island of Madeira, which seemed a little odd because, you know, if you're going north, why would you sail south? But actually that was right because the plan was to sail south all the way down across the equator, around Cape Horn, up the west coast of the Americas, and enter into the Arctic Ocean through the Bering Strait, so that they would be on the Siberian side of the Arctic to catch that east-west drift that they thought would take them over the pole and out towards Greenland. So it didn't raise any eyebrows that they were heading south. But at Madeira, they stopped and they did some restocking and some things. And on September 10th, 1909, all the men who had been on shore leave came back onto the Fram to find Amundsen standing there at the mainmast with a huge map of Antarctica tacked up to the mast, and he revealed his intentions to them. He said, "It's my intention to sail to the southern continent, to land a party, and to try to make it to the South Pole." And the men were just astounded.
They had no idea.
They had no idea. They were shocked. And Amundsen told them all. He said nobody had to go. If anybody didn't want to go to the Antarctic, that was okay. He would pay their passage home to Norway. No hard feelings, no questions asked. And then he looks every single one of them directly in the eye and he says, "Will you join me on this historic expedition?" And every one of them says yes. And he gives them all an hour to go below to their cabins or their bunks and write letters home and tell their families where they're really going to be for the next 2 or 3 years. And he himself uses that same time to write letters to Fridtjof Nansen, who he has borrowed the ship from, and from King Haakon of Norway, who has pledged a great deal of money and support for this expedition. And he confesses his deception, and he begs their forgiveness. And they give all these letters to his brother Leon, and Leon disembarks the ship, and he goes back home to Norway, but he doesn't post those letters until he's safely back in Norway and the Fram is out at sea and way beyond recall.
Nobody's going to stop him at this point.
That's right. He also dictates a telegram that he asks his brother Leon to send to Robert Falcon Scott. And the telegram, it's very short, very terse, and it says, "My dear Captain Scott, I beg leave to inform you, from proceeding Antarctic."
And he knew that was kind of a little spur in the side of
that was,
Mr. Scott.
And that's when the race was on. That right. was the first indication that Scott was going to have some competition mm-hmm. in his desire to get to the pole. So...
Was there another story, too, that you wanted to tell there? Or,
Is there time?
Oh, yeah.
Sure,
yeah,
I would love to. So Amundsen goes down to Antarctica, and he makes his base at a place called the Bay of Whales, which is about 400 miles, east of... McMurdo Sound, where the British expedition is based. And they find an anchorage there at the Bay of Whales, and they find a spot about 2 miles inland where they build a hut that they're going to spend the winter in. They had pre-cut parts and lumber on board the Fram, and Amundsen had brought along a master carpenter, a guy named Christian Stubberud. And Stubberud had actually built the hut in Amundsen's garden, in his backyard, back in Christiania, now uh-huh. Oslo, Norway, and then disassembled it and marked and labeled and numbered all the pieces so it would go back together very easily. And within 2 weeks, they have built the hut, and they name it Framheim, the home of the Fram, and they move in. And exactly 1 week later, another ship sails into the Bay of Whales and is just astonished to see the Fram at anchor there. And that ship is the Terra Nova, because the British expedition, Scott's expedition, has sailed into McMurdo Sound 10 days ahead of the Norwegians, and they too have built the hut. And as soon as their hut is completed, Scott sends the Terra Nova eastward along the coast under the command of Lieutenant Victor Campbell to explore this area that they have named King Edward VII Land, which is over there, you know, in the direction of the Bay of Whales. And when they get to the Bay of Whales and they see the Fram at anchor there, they're absolutely astounded. They had no idea.
Scott hadn't received the telegram yet.
He had received the telegram, but he had no idea where. Antarctica is a vast place, and he had no idea. Plus, you know, there had been some speculation that Amundsen would never even make it to Antarctica. The Fram was a specially built ship, and it was designed with a very round bottom so that it would withstand the crushing pressure of the ice. But that meant that it kind of sailed like an old tub. And in fact, as soon as Scott had heard that Amundsen was going to Antarctica, he had telegraphed Sir Clements Markham back in London, his sponsor, his benefactor. And Markham had said that he doubted that Amundsen would even get to Antarctica because the Fram had no more sailing ability than a haystack. So anyway, there's the Fram at anchor at the Bay of Whales, and the Terra Nova anchors, and they come onto shore, onto the ice there, and they're standing there looking around just sort of dumbfounded and like, what in the world is going on? And here comes Amundsen driving his empty dog sledge. They're still going back and forth from the hut to the ship and bringing stuff up out of the ship to the hut for the winter. And here comes Amundsen over the hill. He's driving his dogs at breakneck speed. He sees the Terra Nova there. He sees Campbell and his men standing there staring, you know, and he takes it all in at a glance. He cracks his whip and the dogs turn sharply and they stop on a dime. He shouts a command and they all sit down in the snow. He gets off the sledge. He walks over to Campbell and he offers his hand for a shake and he says, "Welcome to Antarctica." That's one of my favorite pieces of the whole story right there.
That little rivalry, I guess, was the motivation, both of them.
Right.
I think that gives listeners a taste of the story. Lynn, what you were saying where Lawrence kind of puts us right there in that scene. I felt I was kind of there. I don't know which side. If I had to pick, I'd pick Amundsen, I think, knowing what I know. Lawrence, thanks very much for telling us that.
Thank you so much, Ken. That was fun.
And we should mention before we talk a little bit more about Portland Story Theater, how listeners can see the entire show, where they can get some details and information.
All right. Everything's online at our website, pdxstorytheater.org, and it's really evident where to click to come to the shows.
There's a big button that says buy tickets.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and we
now you tell me.
Yeah, right. That's funny. We honor Arts for All, too. We want everyone to know that because part of our mission is to make this story theater experience accessible to everyone. And we're really the people's theater. We're now performing at the Old Church.
I was going to ask about that. When I first talked with you guys, you were at the Alberta Abbey. That's where I saw the Shackleton show.
Right. Mm.
Then most recently, the Fremont Theater.
Yes.
And now the Old Church. Yes. Did you want to tell a little bit what happened there? Or?
Well, we were at the Fremont Theater. It was an amazing experience for us.
We loved it there.
We loved the owners, David Scher and Johnny Keener. They were amazing people. Sadly, they just couldn't make a go of it. And I think we're still grieving a little bit about that, but we're thrilled and delighted and ecstatic, really, that the Old Church has welcomed us into their venue, and it's a beautiful space. They have beautiful sound. There's a bar. The seating's very comfortable. It's a nice capacity. And we just are really, we've had a couple shows there. We really love it.
So that's our new home, and all the shows of our 2017-18 season will be there at the Old Church.
At the Old Church.
And that will be both the main stage, Armchair Adventure, of course, Lawrence's show, January 6th,
right.
And then the Urban Tellers.
Right. We have a Valentine's on February 10th. We have an Urban Tellers on March 2nd. And then we have a St. Paddy's on March 10th, and then the Immigrant Refugee Urban Tellers is April 6th.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then we have a couple more, one in May and one in June. But, yeah, it's really a beautiful space.
Oh, I want to thank you both for coming into KBOO today, joining us in the neighborhood.
Well, thanks for having
us.
Thank
you so much.
It's really special. We really appreciate your support of Portland Story Theater.
Thank you, Ken.
So we've been talking with Lynn Duddy and Lawrence Howard of Portland Story Theater. And for those listeners who'd like to come out and see Portland Story Theater live, and it's a great experience, you can catch Lawrence very soon telling the tale of polar opposites, Amundsen and Scott, on Saturday, January 6th at the Old Church Concert Hall. That's at 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. Doors at 7, show starts at 8. And as Lynn mentioned, you can find out more at their website with the big Get Tickets button. PDX Story Theater, all one word, PDX Story Theater. org. And to help get you prepared for the show, I'd like to give you a little educational background all about Antarctica.
Let me make it clear, it's really cold down here. So be sure to wrap up warm and tight. You'll need some blubber or fur, or a coat if you prefer. You don't want to lose a toe in the night. Antarctica. Southern Pole.
albatross. The baby seals do like to giggle and laugh. Our giant bergs are all ice. A little ice is all right. But you wouldn't want some in your bag. The poles are getting smaller every year. It's making us think we'll be extinct. Do you want us all to disappear?
Welcome back to Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KABU Community Radio, or KABU Neighborhood Radio, as I like to call it. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation. On today's show, we're talking about our frozen neighbor to the south, Malala. I mean Antarctica. To give us a little lesson about the region, we just heard the Antarctica song from the folks at Sing Song Along, Educational Tunes. And before that, we talked Antarctic and Arctic exploration and storytelling with our live in-studio guests, Lawrence Howard and Lynn Duddy of Portland Story Theater. Now we take you back to those thrilling days of yesteryear, to the golden age of radio, as we hear a tale of the frozen north from the radio program The Adventures of Superman. This episode is called Alonzo Craig, Arctic Explorer. It was originally broadcast back on May 27th, 1940. Here's Superman.
Presenting the transcription feature, Superman.
Up in the sky! Look! It's a bird!
It's a plane!
It's Superman! And now, Superman, mighty visitor from another world, who came to Earth when the planet Krypton was destroyed by quakes and explosions. Superman, who can twist steel in his bare hands, leap tall buildings at a single bound, race a speeding bullet to its target, and who walks about among human beings as champion of the weak and the oppressed, disguised as Clark Kent, news reporter. As our story opens today, we find Kent in the private office of editor Perry White. Listen.
Kent, how would you like to take up the search for Captain Alonzo Craig?
Craig? The Arctic Explorer? Why, he's been missing for 3 years.
Now, look here. Now sit down and let me give you the whole story. Alonzo Craig was one of the most famous Arctic explorers in the world.
Yes, I guess everybody knows that.
Well, 3 years ago, he headed an expedition up into the islands north of Ellesmere Land. You know anything about that country, Kent?
No, not a thing, Chief.
It's very little explored. It's a maze of islands and ice fields and cliffs. And the wildest rumors you ever heard.
What kind of rumors?
Well, most people don't believe them. Alonzo Craig made up his mind he'd prove them one way or the other.
But what kind of rumors?
Well, rumors that the islands north of Ellesmere Land are inhabited by Indians, or maybe Eskimos. Nobody seems to be exactly sure. But they're amazingly intelligent, as far as people can judge. Big and tall and strong, and they're white.
What?
Well, that's what the story is. A race of giant white men. But that isn't all, Kent. Tie your hat on good and tight and catch this. They're ruled by a single king. Some kind of a witch doctor or medicine man, and that witch doctor never dies.
Oh, come on, Mr. White. Don't tell me you fall for stuff like that. just isn't possible.
No, it isn't possible. But Alonzo Craig wasn't a fool, Kent.
Well, don't tell me he believed it.
He went up north to investigate. Traveled thousands of miles over desolate country just 3 years ago this week.
And what happened to him?
Nobody knows. That's why we sent Ray Martin, one of our reporters, up there after him. And old Professor Peters.
Peters? The museum man? Oh, say, I know him well. Well, did Martin report anything?
Not a word in the last month. Both Ray Martin and Professor Peters seem to have vanished in thin air, just like Alonzo Craig did.
You don't mean it.
Well, that's why you're going after them, Kent. You're going to look for Peters and Martin. And if humanly possible, you're going to find out what happened to Alonzo Craig. City room, wipe. Who? Who? Why, yes, yes, certainly I know her. Send her upstairs. Tell the boy to bring her in when she gets here. Say, that's mighty queer. Almost uncanny. You'd never guess in a million years who's coming up.
All right, Mr. White, who is it?
Miss Paula Craig, Alonzo Craig's twin sister.
His sister? What does she want?
Well, that's what I'd like to know myself. She certainly can't have heard about Peters and Martin disappearing.
While we're waiting, what about them? What makes you think they're missing?
Kent, they were supposed to keep in touch by shortwave radio with the base at Port Ormond. They did for a while. 4 weeks ago, the radio went dead.
Oh, well, that might not prove anything, Mr. White.
On the other hand, it might prove a good deal. Because yesterday, I received an important message.
What was that?
Our man at Port Ormond telegraphed it down. It's common gossip among the Indians at the trading post that Martin and Peters have been lost.
Lost? Well, how would Indians know that?
Don't ask me, Kent. Apparently, they do know something, and they won't tell. Come in. Oh, hello. Hello there, Miss Craig.
Oh, Mr. White. I hope I'm not bothering you. They said to come right in.
Why, certainly, by all means. Oh, may I present Mr. Kent? Mr. Clark Kent? Miss Paula Craig.
How do you do?
How do you do?
It's a funny thing you picked out today to come in, Miss Craig. Kent's on his way to Port Ormond in the north.
Mr. White, something's happened, and I don't know what to make of it.
Why, what is it?
You remember about the rings. I think I told you about them.
Well, you might tell Kent.
Mr. Kent, Alonzo and I were twins. When we were graduated from school, my father gave us both identical rings, carrying his initial and our mother's initial in a sort of seal on the back.
Now, the point is, Kent, that Captain Craig always wore his and Miss Craig always wore hers. That is, she did until Ray Martin went north.
Exactly, Mr. White. When you sent your searching expedition north to find my brother, I gave Mr. Martin my ring to take with him. You see, I thought it might help him identify Alonzo.
I understand, Miss Craig. But you said something peculiar happened.
Yes, very peculiar. This morning, I received a small package in the mail. And when I opened it, well, look.
What? Why, that's one of the rings.
Oh, Miss Craig, who sent you that?
Mr. Kent, it came down from Port Ormond by air. My brother's old navigator, Captain Walters, wrote that he bought it from an Indian. It's my brother's ring.
Why, that's amazing.
Great heavens. The time. Look, I never noticed it. Kent, your train leaves in 20 minutes.
My train? Oh, yes, it slipped my mind.
Miss Craig, now, I'm going to be terribly rude now, but I'll make amends some other time.
Mr. White, I don't understand.
Well, now, look here. Kent has only 20 minutes to catch his train. Leave Captain Waller's letter in the ring here, and Kent will take the ring north with him. I'll call you once I get my bearings.
Oh, of course, Mr. White. I hope I haven't upset you.
Oh, fine, fine. You're a real soldier, Miss Craig, a real soldier. And don't worry. I'll call you in a day or two.
All right. Goodbye, Mr. Kent, and good luck.
Goodbye, Miss Craig, and we'll find your brother for you.
Thank heavens. Kent, we'd better work fast.
I'll say so. Mr. White, I can't possibly catch a train in 20 minutes.
Oh, forget it. I have to get her out. Now, Kent, look here. Look. Look at this ring.
Oh, what about it?
She hasn't heard about Martin and Peters being lost. She took it for granted that this was her brother's ring, that somehow it had come back from Alonzo Craig.
What's the letter saying?
Oh, forget the letter. Walters thought the same thing, and they're both wrong.
Mr. White, what do you mean?
Kent, this isn't Alonzo Craig's ring.
What?
They're supposed to be identical, but they're not. I can tell by this scratch on the inside of the band here. See? I put that scratch there myself before Ray Martin took the ring.
Great Scott! You're not saying...
Kent, I am. This is the ring Paula Craig gave to Ray Martin. Now then, what's happened to Martin and Peters? And how under heaven did this ring get back to Port Ormond and into Captain Walter's hands?
Telegram, Mr. White.
Here, give it here. Kent, This is from Captain Wallace, Ike Wallace, up at Port Ormond.
Yes?
He was the one took Alonzo Craig to Ellesmere Land. I told him you were coming.
What's he say?
Urge your man to use all speed. Time may be important. May know more when he gets here. Wallace. Kent, what's going on up there?
Mr. White, I don't know. But I'm going to find out. Say, maybe I can catch that train after all.
Speeding through the upper air, red cape streaming in the wind, the Man of Steel soars over the Great Lakes, northward to Hudson Bay, and northward again to the tiny settlement of Port Ormond. And presently, on the deck of an icebreaker, buffeting her way through the fog and ice, Clark Kent, reporter, talks with the ship's master, Captain Walters.
Any idea where we are, Captain Walters? Mighty heavy fog out there.
Getting up there, Mr. Kent. Any time now, we'll be hitting right into Ellesmere Land. And when we get there, we take the dog sled.
Oh, plenty cold, all right. Say, don't you ever use your foghorn?
Not up here. Except now and again to tell if we're close to an iceberg. Sometimes the sound will bounce off.
Icebergs around here?
Oh, sure up. Mighty lucky if we don't run right into one. Didn't hear no echo that time.
Look here, Captain. Down at dinner, you started to tell me about Alonzo Craig. What's all the mystery about?
Nobody knows, Mr. Kent. All of a sudden, he just up and lit out with only an engine sled driver.
But why? Why would he do a thing like that?
Well, some of the men in his expedition said he heard about the Luck of the North. So he set out to find it.
The Luck of the North?
Yep.
What's that?
That's a treasure, Mr. Kent. Or that's what they say it is. Millions and millions of dollars, gold and precious stones, land knows what not.
What? Up here?
Now, don't ask me if it's true. Don't ask me how it got here, if it is true. All I know is what they tell me.
But where is it? Who owns it?
Well, they say the Indians owned it. Some say it was always here, and some say it come from pirates and such a couple hundred years ago.
Do you believe it yourself?
Mr. Kent, I declare I don't know. I've seen some mighty queer things up here in the north. Hey, ain't it getting some colder all of a sudden?
Oh, I'd say so. Going through me like a knife. Yeah, the fog's thicker, too. Say, look here, Captain.
Yeah?
What about these Indians you were talking about?
Well, nobody knows much about them neither, Mr. Kent. They keep to themselves, and their old witch doctor backs them up. If you ask me, Alonzo Craig went after the Luck of the North, and the Indians went after Craig.
All right, but what about Ray Martin and Professor Peters? Oh, and by the way, you never did tell me how you happened to find that ring.
Now listen. You hear that echo? That means there's a berg right close by.
Huh?
Iceberg! Iceberg dead ahead!
Astern! Full speed astern! Hey, look. Off the starboard beam. Coming through the fog. Iceberg's closing in on us.
Captain Walters, what'll we do? Look! Look!
I see it. I ain't blind. There ain't nothing we can do. Hey, look out! Stay where you are now, Kent. I gotta work fast here. Hold her off! Put your helm down high!
There, he's gone. They'll never see me in the fog. Great heavens, those bergs are all around us. I think it's time Superman went to work. Up! Up! Out! And away! Look at those bergs. They're bigger than mountains. Thousands of tons of solid ice. They're all around the ship. If I can't do something fast, she hasn't got a chance. Down, down, right into the water. Now then, I have to shove this one out of the way. Force a passage for the boat. Good thing they can't see me in the fog.
Now. No.
No good. Not quick enough. The ice is closing in. It's crushing the boat.
Sudden crushing danger in the Arctic ice field. Can Superman force a path for the tiny vessel? Or has he met his match in the towering ice peaks of the northern seas? Tune in next time and follow the story.
Up in the sky! Look! It's a bird!
It's a plane!
It's Superman!
I try.
try so hard, my dear, to show that you're my every dream. Yet you're afraid each thing I do is just some evil scheme. A memory from your lonesome past keeps us so far apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart? Another love before my time made your heart sad and blue. And so my heart is paying now for things I didn't do. In anger, unkind words are said that make the teardrops start. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart? You'll never know how much it hurts to see you sit and cry. You know you need and want my love, yet you're afraid to try. Why do you run and hide from life? To try it just ain't smart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart? There was a time when I believed that you belonged to me. But now I know your heart is shackled to a memory. The more I learn to care for you, the more we drift apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart?
Hey, we just heard Cold, Cold Heart from Hank Williams. And before that, an episode of the 1940 old-time radio show Adventures of Superman. In keeping with our frozen tundra theme today, that was Alonzo Craig, Arctic Explorer. And now we're going to go to John Oliver. He's going to give us a little bit on Antarctica, followed by some cold weather songs from the Rolling Stones.
Let's talk about Antarctica. I'm afraid it's been a week of bad news.
New research from Australian scientists says tourists are threatening the Antarctic biodiversity with pollution and physical disturbances.
More than 40,000 people actually visit Antarctica every single year, and scientists say even walking on moss beds will leave footprints that could last for centuries.
Look, I know this isn't how I'm supposed to react to that, but that really makes me want to walk on an Antarctic moss bed. Which is why Antarctica is in serious trouble. Environmental destruction is not enough to stop the tide of tourists and morning shows desperate for unusual travel segment filler.
You may not think of Antarctica as a vacation destination, but apparently that's changing.
The number one reason folks say they come on tour groups to see those human-like flightless birds, the penguins.
And then they... and then they cry when they're hungry.
Some of the freshest water you'll probably ever taste because it dates back 400,000 years.
What are you doing? Tragically, the Antarctic ice shelf is rapidly diminishing. Now, if you'll excuse me. So pure. So rare. That is the problem. I know we're not supposed to go to Antarctica, but there are free penguins and snow cones there. So they're going to have to launch a pretty strong anti-tourist campaign, or we'll do it for them.
Antarctica, the majestic seventh continent, an unspoiled land of incredible ice formations that you simply have to see. And seeing as how you're looking at them right now, you've technically seen them. So don't come here. Seriously. You want to feel the bracing cold on your skin? Stick your d*** in a freezer. You want to see a seal up close? Here. Here's a seal up close. Now here's a seal in HD. Now it's in 3D. It's like you're actually here, which hopefully you're not. Our point is, you don't need to come here. Want to impress your friends by going someplace exotic? How about Belgium? Have your friends been to Belgium? No? Then it's exotic to them. And if you simply have to have ice, go to Alaska and tell them you went to Antarctica. They won't know the difference. Hey, guess which of these is Alaska? You don't know, do you? It's both of them. We don't care where in the world you go, just so long as it's in this general area and not here. Antarctica. Stop coming here.
Hey, that's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. You just heard Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, Don't Visit Antarctica, and then, of course, She's So Cold. She's cold, 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 the Rolling Stones. Hey, that's it for Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. This episode, a big neighborhood thank you to Lynn Duddy and Lawrence Howard of Portland Story Theater for joining us this morning. You can catch Lawrence's show Polar Opposites, Amundsen Scott and the Race for the Pole, on Saturday, January 6th at the Old Church Concert Hall. That's 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. In addition to Lynn and Lawrence, I'd like to thank all the guests in our premiere season of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. Noah Mickens, Alex Pastrewski, Alexander Mack. That was from the Umbrella Festival's new vaudeville show. Ty Curtis and Jerry Jacobs, of course, from the Ty Curtis Band. They played Portland's Waterfront Blues Festival. John Barber and Sam Mowry of Reimagine Radio and Willamette Radio Workshop, respectively. And of course, big neighborhood thank you to our engineer, the inimitable, unparalleled, unperturbable, and what a mensch, Sam Parrish. So what's coming up for the show in 2018, which is just around the corner? Well, it looks like Mr. Jones's neighborhood is getting gentrified. They're tearing down Mr. Jones's Craftsman bungalow and putting up condos with on-street parking, so it should be a fun season. See you all next show, Friday, March 30th, 2018, at 11 a.m. Until then, wishing you a very happy new year. It's got to be better than the last. I'm your host, Ken Jones. No relation sane. It's another beautiful day in the neighborhood.